completing tonight our study in the Psalm 23, and we're looking at the last verse, but let's read the whole psalm in context. It's in your bulletin, Psalm 23. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He maketh me to lie down in green pastures. He leadeth me beside the still waters. He restoreth my soul. He leadeth me in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. For thou art with me. Thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of mine enemies. Thou anointest my head with oil. My cup runneth over. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. Our focus will be on that last verse, but I want to approach it a little differently tonight. I want to ask the question and try to answer it. What do you do on Monday morning when you wake up and you don't have any confidence? See, this is a series on confidence. And as I have thought about our purpose of growing in confidence, and as I've interacted with some of you about your struggles, as Liz and I took a walk this week on the beach and thought about our own struggles with negative emotions, I realized if we're to accomplish our purpose of growing in biblical confidence, we've got to face the question, what do you do when you wake up and you're not filled with confidence, but you're filled with negative emotions, whether it be anger, whether it be fear, anxiety, whether it be discouragement, depression, what do you do? And so I looked at this last verse in a whole different way when I started asking that question. And I looked at verse 6 and through verse 6 to the rest of the book of Psalms to try to get an answer to the question, how do we deal with the negative emotions that so quickly and so frequently drain us of our Christian confidence? And I want to suggest to you, that, and this is just a start, but I want to suggest to you that from the book of Psalms, I see five things that the Psalms are calling us to do when we grapple with negative emotions. The first thing is to clarify your purpose. Clarify your purpose for dealing with these negative emotions. Let me ask you, when you experience negative emotions, depression, anger, fear, what do you want to do? What is your goal? Well, obviously, if you're like me, you want to get rid of them. You want to change them. You want to put off bad feelings and put on good feelings. Obviously, that's what we want to do. And it's totally wrong purpose. And it's a totally wrong purpose that points to a totally distorted world and life view. A view of reality in which I am the center and everything revolves around me for the purpose of making me happy. A view of reality in which God becomes someone that is useful to giving me a happy life. A view of reality in which the obvious purpose for dealing with negative emotions is to get rid of them. What was David's purpose? David's purpose is clear. It sort of just permeates Psalm 23. It is the heartbeat of the whole psalm. David's purpose in all of life was intimacy with God. In verses 1 and 2, he says, I shall be content. Why? Because the Lord is my shepherd, and he is all I want, and he is all I need. In verses 3 and 4, I shall not fear. Why? Because thou art with me. And then verse 5, I shall triumph. Why? Thou anointest my head. Thou preparest a table. Thou, O Lord, are my victory. And then he reaches the climax of the psalm. That which his whole life purpose is heading toward, the goal of his whole life, and he says it this way, I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. David's life purpose His goal in all that he did was to live in the presence of God. And he was looking forward to that time when he would experience consummated intimacy with his God. That was his purpose. Now let me ask you, is that your purpose? Is that your purpose in life? Now I know for some of you it's not, and I'm glad you're here. And I hope that what I'll say will at least help you understand what one implication is if you should make that your purpose, the purpose of intimate knowledge of God. But for most of you, for many of you, it is your purpose. Now, I didn't ask, are you living consistent with your purpose? I asked, is it your purpose? And for many of you, you'd say, yes, that is my purpose in life, to know God and to know him more intimately. And the question is then, what does that have to do with how we approach negative emotions? It has everything to do with it. What it means is that when we approach negative emotions, that we don't want to approach negative emotions in order to feel better, but rather we want to deal with them in order that we might know God better. In our longings, we don't want God to meet our longings. We want to use our longings to meet God. Do you see the paradigm shift here? That's pretty radical. I have to confess that this is a new application for me. I think it's pretty obvious when you begin to think of it. My natural reaction when the negative emotions come is to use all I know about God to get rid of the negative emotions, instead of using the negative emotion to know about God. You see, the power of this purpose lies in this. It's exactly in line with God's purpose for you. God's purpose for us is that we might know him intimately. And God is in control of everything. He is Lord of everything, including your emotions. And even the bad ones, even the ones you shouldn't feel, God is in control, and God wants to use those emotions to draw you closer to himself. The first thing we need to do when negative emotions come is to catch ourselves. To catch ourselves and correct ourselves from the natural tendency to say, what I want to do is to get rid of this. That is not our purpose. Our purpose is to use those negative emotions to get closer to God. Now, the second thing we have to do, in fact, what's amazing is once you clarify your purpose, it means you have to go back and clarify your question. And when we normally say, well, how do you deal with negative emotions? You're right away thinking, well, how do we turn them into positive emotions? That's not the question anymore, is it? When you say my purpose through my emotions is to get to know God better, now the question is, how can I do that? How can I use these negative emotions, all of my emotions, but it's particularly the negative emotions, to get to know God better? And the second thing I see is, it's sort of trite, but feel your feelings. You may not need to hear that, but I am a recovering, self-deceived optimist. I do that in order to simulate confidence. I have worked very diligently and very hard on this almost all my life, to the point of which I am so good at this, I have feelings I don't even feel. Some of you aren't laughing because you're just like me. Feel your feelings. We all work pretty hard at not feeling unpleasant feelings. They say there's two wrong ways of dealing with unpleasant feelings. One is to blow up. The other is to clam up. I'm a clammer-upper. That is my tendency, so I need to hear this part of the message. Even if you don't, I'm going to say it, okay? many people, in an attempt to help people like me, have said, they have taught that emotions are amoral. They're neither right nor wrong. They just are. And the important thing is what you do with them. Now, their concern is that if you say that emotions are either right or wrong, then it makes it harder for us to be honest about emotions. Now, their intent is good, but the view is wrong for two reasons. Number one, that view assumes that one part of our personality, namely our emotions, has escaped the effects of the fall. That somehow our emotions have not become twisted and tainted by sin, but are essentially pure. That's the one problem with that approach. The other problem with the approach is it misses the fact that in order to understand our difficult emotions, we have to understand why they're difficult. We have to understand why we try to avoid them. And why do we try to avoid certain negative emotions? The reason we do is we don't like what they show us. We don't like what we see in them. We don't like to see what they expose, namely the sin and suffering of the world and the darkness of our own hearts. We would rather live with the myth that life is pretty safe and predictable. And people, especially you and me, are basically good. And our negative emotions destroy that myth. No wonder we don't like to feel them. The Psalms call us, however, to feel our feelings and to express them to God. In Psalm 23, verse 6, David expresses utter confidence in living with God forever. But he didn't always feel that way. There were times when he was gripped by the fear of death. In fact, in Psalm 30, which is actually praising God for saving him from death, he quotes something he had said to God previously when he was filled with fear. And he says, "What gain is there in my destruction? In my going down into the pit, will the dust praise you? Will it proclaim your faithfulness? Hear, O Lord, and be merciful to me. O Lord, be my help." You see, David was gripped with a fear of death. And don't get the idea that Psalm 23 is after he's had time to mature. That Psalm 23 is a mature David after he's outgrown his fear of death. No, the Psalms intersperse the Psalms of celebration and the Psalms of lament because God recognizes that life is a mixture of celebration and lament, of sorrow and joy. So the point is, as long as we live on this earth, we're going to have to feel our feelings, the negative ones as well, and express them to God. You don't outgrow that. In fact, there's a sense in which as you grow, you feel them more deeply. And so we're to feel our feelings. The Psalms call us to do that. Now let me make two what I think are important clarifications right at this point so that I don't mislead anybody. Number one, I am not saying that negative emotions are simply a matter of the soul. God has made us body and soul, and there's a very complex interplay between the two. Some emotions like anxiety and depression can and should be treated with medication and other medical procedures. And to tell someone that that's wrong or to tell someone it's a second best option is not only cruel, it's wrong. It's incorrect. It's wrong. It's not true. The second thing I want to clarify is that I'm not encouraging self-focused introspection. Self-centered contemplation of our inner life runs totally contrary to the other-centeredness of Christian maturity. What I am encouraging, because I believe the Psalms encourage us to examine ourselves inwardly that we might find out what we're doing with God. And that we might grow, therefore, in intimacy with Him. The reason that I encourage us to, I'm preaching this to myself, remember, to feel our feelings is because God reveals Himself to us in His Word, in His world, and in us, and in our emotions. And our emotions are a window through which we can glimpse the very character of God, even our negative emotions. A window through which we can glimpse the very heart of God, because God has fear, God has anger, God has at times experiences despair, God is jealous, you see? And all of those emotions point to the character of God. And ultimately, each of those points to the horror and the beauty of the cross. And so as you begin to feel and ponder your feelings, you begin to understand the glorious nature of the fact that the Son of God died on your behalf. And as a result, this type of insight ultimately leads to worship. It leads to worship. So clarify your purpose, feel your feelings. Thirdly, redirect your longings. Redirect your longings. You see, beneath our difficult feelings are deep longings. When I experience negative emotions and I push the why question, and I push the why question, why am I feeling like this, why, I ultimately get down to three categories of longings. My longing for strength. I want to be a competent, capable person who's in control of myself and the things around me. My longing for security. I want myself and the things I love to be safe. And my longing for significance. I want to be accepted, loved, respected. And you see what happens when something I look to fulfill those longings is lost or threatened. I experience negative emotions. Anger indicates that something I'm longing for is blocked. When someone gets in my way of something that I'm longing for, I get angry. Anxiety or fear indicates that something I'm longing for is uncertain. The attainment of it looks unlikely. Depression indicates that something I'm looking to and longing for is impossible. Circumstances, situations have made the attaining of that through the thing I'm looking to impossible. And of course, the problem is I'm looking to certain things to fulfill those longings that can be blocked, that can be uncertain, that can be impossible. And what am I really longing for? See, what we're really longing for is not just strength, security, and significance. What we're longing for is perfect strength, perfect security, perfect significance. David says what he's longing for is that he may dwell in the house of the Lord forever. What we're longing for is to live in the presence of the one who designed us. To live in the presence of the only one who can give us perfect strength, security, and significance. And what we need to do when we wrestle with negative emotions is that we need to redirect those longings. The Psalms do that so well. It's amazing when I started to see how this worked. Psalm 27, for example. In Psalm 27, the emotion is fear. There's mention of fear, of pain, fear of death, fear of rejection, abandonment, fear of criticism. And the psalmist, through pondering those things, knows that what he's really longing for cannot be fulfilled in himself or anybody else. And he says this, one thing I've asked of the Lord, this is what I will seek, that I may dwell in his house all the days of my life, gaze upon his beauty, and seek him in his temple. You see how he redirected his longings. He knew it was a longing for God. In Psalm 42, the emotion is depression. David has hit rock bottom. Psalm 42 is about as low as you can go. And there he realizes that what he's longing for, it can only be God. And he says, as the deer pants for the streams of water, so my soul pants for you, O God. My soul thirsts for God, for the living God. When can I go and meet with God? You see how he's taking his eyes off the things that you and I usually look to fulfill our longings, and he puts it, what he's really longing for is intimacy with God, to be with God. And then in Psalm 73, it's the emotion of anger. The anger of envy. Getting angry when someone who is less deserving than me has what I want. And the psalmist's complaint is, the evil are prospering and I'm getting a raw deal. What good is it to follow God? It doesn't help a bit. And then he says this, and then I entered into the temple. I entered into God's presence and reality sank in. And he declares this. He shifts his longing, his focus. He redirects it. And he says, whom have I in heaven but thee? And on earth there is nothing I desire besides you. My flesh and my heart may fail, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever. Do you see what the Psalms are doing? They are feeling to the depth, the feeling. And they're seeing that points to a deep, deep longing. And they realize that there's nothing on this earth. There's no person. There's no relationship. There's nothing you or I can do to meet that longing. But what it is, it's a longing for the living God. And they look to him. What you need to see, I believe, in these Psalms is that these great assertions of longing for God and commitment to God come either right after or right in the midst of wrestling with negative, even sinful emotions. Because it's in the wrestling with those that the psalmist realizes that under those emotions are deep longings that only can be met in God. And what you also need to see from these psalms is that simply clarifying your purpose, feeling the feelings, and redirecting a longing does not necessarily immediately change the negative emotion. But you see, that wasn't the purpose all along anyway, was it? But it does draw you into the potential of a life-changing encounter with God. Redirect your longings. And as you redirect your longings, what you need to do, and this is the fourth thing, is to remember God's kindness. Remember God's covenant kindness. When David says, surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, that word mercy is a very special Hebrew word. Bible scholars have found that word is almost a technical word that's used in a very special way. It's a Hebrew word, hesed. And it is used in connection with God's mercy and God's kindness in connection with his covenant. The covenant he has entered into with his people. And there is a beautiful picture of this. In fact, I'm going to show that there's a very close tie between Psalm 23 and this picture in 2 Samuel 9. There, David has just driven out his enemies. He has taken the throne. He's now the undisputed king. And David says this as king. He says, is there anyone still left of the house of Saul to whom I may show hesed, kindness, covenant kindness, for the sake of Jonathan. Now, first of all, real quickly, that is just one of the most unusual requests in the context of the ancient Near East. Because in the ancient Near East, the normal practice when a new king took the throne was to kill all of the family of the previous king in order to eliminate any threat, any rival for the throne. And yet David's not saying he wants to kill who's ever left. He says, I want to show them hesed, kindness. And why is that? He says, for Jonathan's sake. And you see, Jonathan was Saul's son. Saul, who persecuted and pursued, tried to kill David. But Jonathan was David's best friend. In fact, they entered into a covenant of friendship. And in that covenant, Jonathan said to David, because he knew that David was going to be king, he says, when you become king, promise me that you will extend hesed, there it is again, kindness to me, and that you will not kill me. Because he knew the normal practice. And he says, and promise to me also that when you become king, that you will extend hesed, just like the Lord's hesed, to my family, that you will not kill them. See what he's doing. And David enters into that covenant of friendship with Jonathan. And now David is king. Jonathan and Saul have been killed in battle. And David remembers his covenant with Jonathan. He says, is there anyone left of his family to whom I can show hesed, kindness, for Jonathan's sake? They discover there is one, that Jonathan had a son, and we know that his name was Mephibosheth. And we also know some interesting things about him from the text, not too much. We know that he was crippled in both feet. It resulted as a result of an accident when he was 5 years old, when his babysitter heard that Saul and Jonathan were killed in battle. She knew what was going to happen next. David would become king, and any descendants would be killed, including Mephibosheth. Even though he's 5 years old, he was a threat. She grabs a hold of him, goes running out, and in the rush, there's an accident. She must fall. She drops him. He's crippled in both feet. He's now an adult because he has his own son. And the Bible tells us that he's living in a little town on the east side of the Jordan, outside of Israel. He's living in a place called Lodabar. And Lodabar means no pasture. And it probably refers to this desert wasteland where this little hole in the wall was located. He has been hiding there because he did not know about the covenant of friendship between David and Jonathan. He would not have known. That was a secret that had to be kept from Saul. And so he has been raised all his life to resent David. That's why he's crippled. He blames it on him. And to fear David because he knows his life is at risk. And the next thing he knows, there are soldiers at his door sent by the king to bring him to David. And they bring him to David, and he falls down before David, bows in fear. He figures, this is it. It's curtains. It's all over. His body must be shaking uncontrollably, and his life is passing through his mind. And all of a sudden, he hears the king say, don't be afraid. I want to show you hesed, for your father Jonathan's sake. Can you imagine? Can you imagine Mephibosheth at that point struggling with whether this could be true, whether to believe it or not, or if it's just some cruel trick before they kill him? And David says, I'm going to restore to you all the land, all the inheritance that was your grandfather's, King Saul. The wealth would have been incredible. But also it meant a place in the promised land, an inheritance in Israel. And then he goes on, it gets even better. He says, and I want you to eat at my table for the rest of your life. And it even goes better than that, because it goes on to say, Mephibosheth always ate at David's table like one of the king's sons. And the story ends very interestingly by saying Mephibosheth always ate at the king's table, and he was crippled in both feet. End the story. And I scratched my head. What a crazy way to end the story. He always ate at the king's table, and he was crippled in both feet. Why does the author end the story like that? Well, because that's the punchline. That's the point of the whole story. The lavish kindness shown to one who was totally, totally unworthy. You see, because he was crippled, he couldn't serve as a servant in David's house, or he couldn't serve as a soldier in David's army. Like, David's kindness to Mephibosheth would bring nothing in return to David. Absolutely nothing. It was unconditional kindness. Friends, when you struggle with negative emotions, you need to remember God's covenant kindness. That you and I, like Mephibosheth, are totally undeserving of any blessing, of any good from the king. When we struggle with negative emotions, there's always that underlying element that I deserve something. That it's not fair, this shouldn't be happening. And what this story tells me is, just like Mephibosheth, I'm totally unworthy of any of God's blessings. I was his enemy. I was living far from him in a spiritual wasteland. I'm crippled and of no benefit or use to him. And yet, like David, God has lavished just amazing, amazing grace and kindness upon us. That not only does he save my life from destruction, give me an eternal inheritance, but he invites me to eat at his table and experience intimacy with the King of Kings. And not only that, it says that he adopts us into his own family as his sons and daughters. The Apostle John, sort of marveling at the covenant kindness of God, puts it this way. God lavished his love upon us in this, that we are the children of God. What an amazing thing, just a mind-boggling thing, totally unworthy, and yet he has blessed us in that way. Now, we don't experience that. At times we get glimpses and foretastes, but you see, we still experience the pain and the heartache of living in Lodabar. One day, we will fully experience what it means to enter into the king's presence and to sit at his table and have the type of intimacy that that David is a picture to us for. But one thing we can be certain of is that in the midst of those negative emotions, that what we're really longing for, one day we will fully realize. And far beyond anything we ever could have imagined or believed or hoped or dreamed of. One day, all that we long for, all perfect security, perfect strength, perfect significance will be realized. And the reason why we can be absolutely sure of that is because it's for the sake of another. You know, some of you, I experienced the same thing. We wrestled with negative emotions. We look at ourselves and we say, God couldn't love me. How can he put up with this sort of thing? And he even knows better than I do how dark it is in there. My pride, my self-centeredness, how could he put up with that? And I'm sure Mephibosheth at times, the thought crossed his mind, how can this be? I'm not worthy. I don't deserve to be sitting so close to the king at the table. I don't deserve this. And he may have started to be fearful again and become resentful. And then he would remember, but I'm not here for my own sake. I'm here for the sake of my father, Jonathan. And friends, don't ever forget that all these blessings that are ours all these things that we long for and we look forward to and we will one day have in all their fullness are not because of our sake, but for the sake of another. That our eternal inheritance, our fellowship with God, our status as sons and daughters is based on one irrevocable fact, that God has sealed a covenant of friendship with the precious blood of his only begotten Son, and has taken us into the scope of that covenant, promising to protect us and to keep us and to ultimately bring us home. So as we wrestle with negative emotions and the longings that underlie them, take them to the gospel. Take them to God's covenant kindness in Jesus Christ. Just one more thing, and that's this following one. Not only do we need to know God's kindness, we need to show God's kindness. If we're going to respond to our negative emotions in a way that enables us to know God better, it means showing God's kindness even when we don't feel like it. Because we do it not for other people's sake, not for our sake, but for the sake of the Lord Jesus Christ. There is an amazing, I just can't get over the connection between Psalm 23 and the story of Mephibosheth. I mean, if you see the parallels, there's the king's house, there's the king's table, there's the king's chesed. There are so many parallels that I'm convinced it's not coincidental. David's involved in both places. One place, David, in Psalm 23, David is the guest. In the story of Mephibosheth, David is the king. And I don't know which came first, I don't know, but I do know this. There is a close connection between knowing God's kindness and showing God's kindness. That if you know God's kindness, you will show God's kindness. And as you show God's kindness, you know God's kindness in a deeper way. Do you know God's kindness? Well, if you know Jesus Christ, you know God's kindness. And if you know God's kindness, you will show God's kindness. Have you been showing God's kindness to others unconditionally? Have you been showing it to those who don't deserve it? Those who can't pay back? Those who are in some way of no real benefit to you? Do you show them unconditional kindness for the sake of another? Or do people have to earn your love? Do people have to earn your kindness? Do you have a bookkeeping mentality of keeping score, or do you have a grace perspective? Well, I don't do too well in those questions. I don't do too well at all, to tell you the truth. What do we do about it? We come to him, and we depend upon his kindness. That it's for the sake of another, for the sake of Jesus Christ, that he welcomes us, that he forgives us, and that he enables us then to show that kindness to others. There's five things that as I'm wrestling with negative emotions, I'm finding give me direction. To clarify your purpose, to feel your feelings, to direct your longings, to know God's kindness, and to show God's kindness, even when you don't feel like it. Now, that's a lot to load on you, 5 points. Preachers only allowed 3. And that's a lot. And I just want to tell you 2 things that I've determined myself to do with this message and encourage you to do the same 2 things. And it goes back to what I think is the starting point, and that is clarifying your purpose. I want to go on record of saying that I'm clarifying my purpose, that when negative emotions come, I'm not going to try to feel better. I'm going to commit myself to using those negative emotions to know God better, regardless of the immediate outcome. That's my purpose. I'm committing myself to that. And I know that is going to be very, very, it's going to call for a lot of hard work. and a lot of grace, because I get into a deep rut of self-centeredness. And it's going to take discipline, it's going to take prayer, and it's going to take help from others. And so the second thing I'm doing is I'm going to tell some people that I'm making that commitment. And I'm going to tell some people also in a more personal way than right here and ask them to hold me accountable to that commitment. A small group, wife and family, and ask them to pray and to hold me accountable to that. That's what I would encourage you tonight as we close in prayer, that you would do the same thing. That you'd make that commitment before the Lord, a radical paradigm shift in your purpose for dealing with negative emotions. And then you would tell at least one other person and ask them to pray for you and to hold you accountable and give them the license the next time you're struggling with negative emotions, if need be, that they will say, "Brother, sister, I think you've got your purpose all messed up here. Are you really seeking to know God better through this?" Let's pray. Father, I find it very freeing and even exciting to know that you are Lord of my emotions. Lord, even of negative, dark, sinful emotions. And that in those things, you desire to reveal yourself more clearly to me, that I might know you better and be drawn into your embrace. Father, forgive me and forgive my brothers and sisters as they have sought to get rid of bad feelings instead of using bad feelings to get to know you better. Lord, bring to our mind this truth over and over again. Enable us by your grace to pursue you, to know what we're longing for, and to go after you with reckless abandon. Father, bring people around us with whom we can share this common commitment and help each other. For we ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.